This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Thanks for downloading the Today in Parliament podcast for Friday, the 27th of October. This is Mark Darcy. In this edition, peers have backed a bill to ban unpaid internships.
How should you treat them? Pay them.
The behind-the-scenes campaign to put legalising assisted dying back on the Commons agenda.
What I've said to a number of MPs is that if you're going to deny people that choice at the end of their life, then you have to be willing to stand at the bedside and witness their horrific death.
And the MP calling for government action to clamp down on international puppy smugglers.
There's organised gangs now breeding these puppies. They're then sent on horrendous journeys, often not fed, in horrendous conditions.
But first tonight, there's been strong backing in the Lords for a ban on unpaid internships, which last more than 4 weeks. The Conservative peer, Lord Holmes of Richmond, proposed the ban in a private members' bill, arguing that while companies increasingly wanted to see evidence of work experience from job applicants, only 4% of young people could afford to work unpaid for long.
It's about fairness, it's about equality, but even if neither of those two things float your boat, it's simply about talent. 4% can undertake unpaid internships with no financial difficulties. Why would an organisation, why would a business want to exclude 96% of the potential talent pool from that organisation?
He said the law didn't provide protection because individuals had themselves to make a legal challenge if they thought they were entitled to be paid.
How likely is that, my lords, that somebody who is undertaking this internship to try and increase their social mobility, to undertake this internship to build a career for the rest of their lives, how likely is it that they will bring a case against that organisation?
His bill would simplify matters.
Crucially, it provides this clarity to employers in terms of how to treat interns. The clarity is this. How should you treat them? Pay them.
The Labour peer Lady Morgan's a former head of Ofsted. She welcomed Lord Holmes's bill.
At times, it almost feels as if every time progress is made, barriers are broken, a new barrier is erected to make progress for disadvantaged students more difficult again. And the new one, my lords, in the last decade or so, is unpaid internships. About a third of graduate internships are still unpaid.
Those unpaid internships don't necessarily lead to a permanent job either. To prepare for the debate, the Conservative Lady Stoll had spoken to a young friend about his long and difficult search for a paid job. She quoted him.
Most of my internships have been very frustrating, especially when you work hard and you prove yourself time and time again by demonstrating your passion, work ethic and commitment, but to no avail. Lords, I don't know about your lordships, but I would find it hard to keep going if that was the way I was being treated time and time again.
Several peers noted that unpaid internships were much more prevalent in certain industries, including politics, as the non-party peer Lord Mitchell explained.
To our shame, even in your lordship's house or in the other place, there have been unpaid interns, a fact which is to be deplored. Many fashion houses, art galleries, publishing houses and advertising agencies do the same. And why do they do it? Because they can. Young people clamour to work in sexy, exciting companies.
Or if not exactly sexy, at least prestigious, like the House of Lords. Karen Brady, Lady Brady, a Conservative and one of the stars of the BBC One show The Apprentice, highlighted the difference between an internship and a short period of unpaid work experience, which would be permitted under the bill.
It helps young people understand what careers might be right for them and what they can expect when they get into work. But it is very obviously not a job. They are not doing something an employer needs to have done for no cost.
While most peers who spoke backed the bill, Labour's Lord Winston did have reservations.
People who come into a laboratory just for 4 weeks are not only useless, they're actually dangerous. They can actually make your work more difficult and they can destroy things. It takes a lot of experience.
But a Conservative, Lady Jenkin, highlighted a young woman she knew who'd travelled from her home in Essex to do an unpaid internship with a charity in London.
Catherine says, when I look back on it, it was a huge expense for me at the time.
Internships are only for privileged people living in the capital. I don't come from a well-off family. My dad is a labourer and my mum works in a call centre. The internship definitely opened doors for me. It was all I talked about in my interview for my current job. But the irony of working for free whilst working on an anti-slavery and poverty reduction project was not lost on me.
For the government, Lord Younger of Lecky said existing law should protect unpaid interns.
The heart of this issue is enforcement. It's enforcing existing legislation to enable social mobility. So to be clear, it is against the law for employers not to pay at least the minimum wage to workers. We want work to pay and to have zero tolerance for employers opting out of their legal responsibilities.
As is usual in the Lords, the bill wasn't opposed at this early stage, and it now goes forward for detailed consideration. But it remains rare for private members' bills proposed by peers to make it into law. Is the government now so busy with Brexit that the Commons Select Committees are stepping in to drive policy and even draft new laws? With millions of people in Britain now working in the so-called gig economy, the government commissioned Tony Blair's former policy guru, Matthew Taylor, to review the way the 21st century labour market now works, looking at whether new working practices allow companies to exploit people, deny employment rights and pay less tax. The Work and Pensions and the Business Select Committees have been conducting a joint inquiry into his report. Among other witnesses, they heard from Hugo Martin of the delivery firm Hermes, who said his deliverers liked their self-employed status.
They're very happy being self-employed. It provides the self-employment model creates a flexible framework to which allows us to provide these opportunities in the first place. The work fits around the life of the couriers and their life is such that they would not be able to access traditional PAYE employment.
Their key witness was Matthew Taylor, the author of the review.
Sometimes we understand this issue as kind of workers' rights versus business and employers. Actually, what is often happening is that there are businesses who are treating their workers well and paying employment taxes, who are finding it incredibly hard to compete with companies who have found ways to avoid respecting workers' rights and paying business taxes.
Well, as they prepare their joint report, the Labour MPs Frank Field, Chair of the Work and Pensions Committee, and Rachel Reeves, Chair of the Business and Industrial Strategy Committee, are also drafting changes to the law and asking the Prime Minister if they can bring them in. They told me about their next moves.
I think we will move quite quickly to a report and a draft bill. So I think we'll have a major reform for the government to consider, centering on the insecurity and the inability of workers who feel they are workers not to be able to get the cover of the National Living Wage.
So you've got two select committees drafting a bill here.
Yes, and what we hope is between our two select committees we can agree on some draft legislation that has cross-party support and then put it to the Prime Minister and the government. Then we hope that either she will take it forward or give the opportunity for the two select committees to turn our draft clauses into a bill to take through Parliament, really to get those changes at work that would give more security and better protection for some of the most lowest paid and also the most precarious work.
And Frank, you've been talking directly to the Prime Minister.
I spoke to the Prime Minister on Wednesday after Prime Minister's question time. I said, could we, as a constitutional development, look to her protection, give us time, access to civil servants to take this bill through the Commons. Her response was, well, we might want to adopt your proposals. And, of course, Rachel and I would be pleased if that were the outcome.
What we would like to see, things, for example, like greater clarity in the law about who is a worker and who is self-employed, better support for agency workers so that they are entitled to some of the rights that ordinary workers, directly employed workers, are entitled to. Looking, for example, as Matthew Taylor did in his review, at whether you should be paid more for hours that are not guaranteed to try and reduce this reliance that business seem to have on the zero-hour contracts or the short-hour contracts and try and change that so workers have greater security day-to-day and week-to-week about how much work they're going to have.
And is there, Frank Fielder, thought about trying to kind of equalise the tax that is paid or the national insurance that is paid as between the self-employed and the employed?
We're certainly anxious that the cheap ride that many companies get in not paying taxes by claiming a probably a false statement for their workforce.
You think that's, as it were, false self-employment?
Well, on two consecutive committee hearings now, we've been given a choice. Are you going to allow the law to be codified by endless people going to court to try and get it codified? Or do you see your job as parliamentarians as codifying the law in a clear manner so that employers know what their duties are?
Do you see, as it were, a gap here? The government's so preoccupied with Brexit at the moment that there's a chance for people like you, yourselves, on the committee corridor to drive policy forward while ministers are busy thinking about the EU?
Well, I hope that they do allow that to happen, because there's an awful lot happening in the world, whether those be with the issue of social care or housing, or in this case about the world of work, that can't wait until after Brexit. And what we're offering the government is going to be some draft clauses that have cross-party support that they can take quickly through the House of Commons, and in doing so make the life of working people a little bit better.
So, Frank, you've done the groundwork for ministers already.
Well, I would wish the government was more concentrated on Brexit. Nor are we getting the reform programme. We are in a new era of a minority government that is trying to govern effectively. Harold Wilson faced this position. He knew what to do. He let backbenchers, then, this occasion it will be select committees, legislate with government protection, then claim the credit when it all went well. And I would have thought that was a very good way of Mrs. May building up her social legacy.
Frank Field and Rachel Reeves. And now to Strasbourg, where the European Parliament's been meeting, and MEPs have been discussing reports of sexual harassment by some of their number. Adam Fleming's been investigating.
The issue of sexual harassment shot up the agenda of the European Parliament after the prominence of the global campaign called Me Too. Wednesday's debate began with a passionate statement from European Commissioner Cecilia Malmström.
These stories shout to us. It's a feminist outcry from all across the world, from women who said, enough. This is enough. We refuse to be silent. We refuse to accept. Workplaces all over the world, including in the European Union and the institution, must look at how we can address this. Do we do enough? Are there enough tools to listen to those signals, to catch those stories, to act in an appropriate way? And this is work that needs to be done by men and women together.
MEP after MEP explained how they'd been affected during their lives. Terry Reinke is a Green from Germany.
Me too. I have been sexually harassed, just like millions of other women in the European Union. And I think it's about time that we very clearly say that we should not be ashamed, but that the perpetrators should be ashamed.
But the spotlight was turned onto the institution itself following a series of media reports of inappropriate behaviour by MEPs towards their staff. Hilde Votmans, a Liberal from the Netherlands, gave a graphic summary of some of them.
The MeToo hashtag heeft
The Me Too hashtag has brought in a great range of shocking stories from a number of sectors, but also sadly from this house. Masturbation in offices, women being harassed in the lift. These are things that should not exist in 2017. And what about the power relationship? If it's your boss doing it, you've got to pay off your mortgage, feed your kids.
Of course, parliamentary staff themselves couldn't contribute to the debate, so the BBC spoke to one assistant, Jean Ponte, who kept a diary detailing 47 alleged incidents involving her and her colleagues.
I have testimony of some of my friends who were like following in the corridor by members of a hand on their ass and stuff like that. So it's really hard, or like really not appropriate messages received at the middle of the night. Also, me, I received once an email coming from a political advisor with picture taking of myself without me knowing, obviously. So I was working in a conference room, and this man just took pictures of me and sent it to me on my professional address at the middle of the night.
Some, like the former UKIP leader Diane James, warned against a knee-jerk response.
What is clear is that we don't have a process currently whereby individuals and alleged perpetrators can go to, can resort to, and ask for a suitable investigation. And I do believe that the vote that we're going to have tomorrow morning is bringing this forward too quickly, and we have not addressed sufficiently the scale of what is going on, the nature of what is going on, and I would suggest we go forward with a questor responsibility on this.
We will now proceed with the vote on the report.
A day later, on Thursday, the Parliament voted overwhelmingly in favour of a motion that called on the authorities to review their processes for dealing with complaints and for the creation of a task force of independent experts to tackle the problem.
In favour, and it has been approved. Congratulations.
That report from Adam Fleming in Strasbourg. Now, has this Commons vote from September 2015 turned out to be rather less significant than people thought at the time?
The ayes to the right, 118. The noes to the left, 330.
That was the defeat by 212 votes of the private members' bill from the Labour MP Rob Maris to legalise assisted dying for terminally ill people in the UK. So emphatic was the vote, it seemed the issue would be banished from the political agenda for decades. But with a new parliament and a new atmosphere, there are moves behind the scenes at Westminster to prepare the ground for a further attempt to change the law. At the centre of them is the Conservative Kit Malthouse.
In the immediate aftermath of that incredibly disappointing debate, that might well have been the case, but since then, the all-party group on choice at the end of life, which I'm the chair, is being very active in Parliament now, recruiting people to the cause, particularly in the Conservative Party at the moment, and also test out who is dead against, who is dead for, and who's kind of floating around in the middle. Because one thing that became clear from the debate in 2015 was that there were lots of people who weren't quite sure and who took their lead either from the medics or the religious lobby or indeed from the leadership of the party, because the then Prime Minister David Cameron was against. So we are beavering away.
Obviously we've got a new parliament now. Are there other things that are changing, as it were, under the surface?
Absolutely. First of all, there is an acceleration of the adoption of assisted dying around the world. Six states now in the US, including California, Canada last year. We've just this week had a vote in the Victoria Parliament in Australia. So there is this big development overseas. And secondly, we're seeing more and more high-profile cases in the UK. Noel Conway at the moment, who's appealing his challenge to the law up to the Supreme Court. And Dignity in Dying, the organisation that kind of coordinates a lot of this work, is being much more assertive about putting these cases in front of politicians and the media. So the two things together are creating an atmosphere where I'm hopeful we might see some movement on this in the next 5 to 10 years.
And are individual MPs coming across this issue more and more now?
They are. Certainly I've been encouraging individuals, for instance, who might have motor neuron disease and want the right to choose the place and manner of their own death, to show up to MP surgeries and ask why the MP is unwilling to give them the choice they need at the end of their life. Because we know personal witness of people who are in a distressing situation with a terminal disease who wish to end their lives with some dignity has a huge effect on whether MPs vote or not. Quite a lot of MPs in the debate back in 2015 spoke about their own personal experience, as did I, of a member of their family or a close friend who was basically begging to be allowed to go. And what I've said to a number of MPs is that if you're going to deny people that choice at the end of their life, then you have to be willing to stand at the bedside and witness their horrific death, because that is what you are condemning them to. And so making it real for people is key to the argument.
And is there now a bill round the corner, the next round of private members' bills or something like that, or are you biding your time in this campaign?
We're biding our time to a certain extent. So it's only a couple of years ago that we had the bill. I mean, looking back on it, that bill was sprung on a new parliament pretty early on. I mean, I'd only been elected, a few months, as had quite a lot of my colleagues who were unsure. So if there's going to be a bill in the future, possibly in the next parliament, then we're going to need to put in the preparation.
Kit Malthouse. Back now to today's debates in the Lords, where the former Ulster Unionist leader Lord Empey launched his second attempt to secure compensation for victims of Libyan-backed IRA attacks. His previous bill had fallen because of the snap election. Lord Empey said the Gaddafi regime had supplied several shiploads of arms and explosives to the IRA, and these had been used in a series of atrocities.
There has been a perception that Gaddafi-sponsored terrorism was primarily a Northern Ireland issue, but this is not the case. Victims are located all around our nation. The number of GB-based soldiers who were killed and injured is substantial, as have been a significant number of high-profile attacks. For example, we had the Harrods bombing, the Canary Wharf bombing, the Baltic Exchange, and the notorious Hyde Park bombing.
His Ulster Unionist colleague, Lord Rogan, said other countries had extracted compensation from Libya, and Britain's failure to do so was a national scandal.
Why should our people be less favourably treated than Americans, French and German citizens? Surely British governments, of whatever political complexion, should be standing up for the rights and interests of British citizens.
The Labour former Northern Ireland Secretary Lord Reid backed the bill, saying that victims of IRA attacks had never had the same opportunity to win compensation as victims of violence by British security forces.
Anyone who claimed that they suffered as a victim of British violence had opportunities to claim compensation that was denied to many others. In this case, as Lord MP has pointed out, they were actually the victims, directly and indirectly, of a state, the state of Libya.
Lord MP wanted the victims to be compensated out of the nearly £10 billion of assets from the Gaddafi regime, which had been frozen in Britain, a move which the Foreign Office Minister, Lord Ahmad, warned would breach international law. But he added the government was pressing for compensation to be paid.
We continue to raise this issue at the highest level with the administration in Libya, including the Prime Minister.
Lord MP warned the government that there would be no let-up in his campaign.
This is not a matter that the government can sit on its hands over. And I hope that the contribution that the Minister has made today, when he says that the government will seek redress, that implies that it will actually do something.
No peer spoke against the bill, and it now goes forward for detailed scrutiny. And the day's third private member's bill was an attempt by the Lib Dem, Lord Tyler, to change election spending rules so that parties could no longer, as he put it, buy elections.
Come on.
I come to the park just outside Parliament, in the shadow of the Victoria Tower, where pampered political pooches are frolicking alongside rescue dogs at Westminster's annual Dog of the Year show. It's an event organised every year by the Dogs Trust. But there is a darker side to the canine world, the side of puppy smuggling, an issue that's going to be raised in a debate next week by the Conservative MP Nigel Huddleston.
There's organised gangs now breeding these puppies. They're then sent on horrendous journeys, often not fed and watered properly. They're in horrendous conditions, but they somehow get through the borders because they're often not properly checked and then are just not in very good conditions when they arrive. So there's an animal welfare issue there. And then the other angle is the kind of consumer angle, the dog lover angle. People are buying these puppies without realising where they came from. So one of the most important things we want to do is try and raise awareness so that if anybody is looking at buying a puppy, ask the questions, where did it come from? Does it properly have the certificates? There's meant to be these pet passports, but they're often fabricated. Unfortunately, there's some vets out there, particularly in Eastern Europe, who are giving pet passports erroneously, vaccination certificates that aren't real. Because there's so much money in this is a real industry.
And these are what? Pedigree puppies of recognisable breeds? Theoretically pedigree, anyway.
They're absolutely the high end, because some of these dogs, and in particular we're talking about pugs, dachshunds and bulldogs, they can go for up to £1,500 each. And the UK often pays more than they would sell for in, say, France, Germany and elsewhere. So that's why the UK is particularly being targeted.
And what do you want done about this? How can the government clamp down? Should it be jailing puppy smugglers?
Certainly some people are saying that we should throw them into prison, and, you know, I can understand that. But I think the most important and effective thing is to hit them in their pocket. So on-the-spot fines for anybody trying to bring in a puppy illegally in the UK. That also means making sure that the checks are there at the ports in the way that they're not at the moment. And then also education as well, and say really making sure that people are aware when they buy a puppy, ask where it's come from. I think we're pushing an open door here. I think the government's quite keen to make some changes, and there's certainly huge popular will for it.
Nigel Huddleston. And that's all from us for this week. But just time to tell you about a particular treat over on BBC Parliament this weekend. A parliamentary coup tells the story of the 1979 confidence vote that overthrew James Callaghan's Labour government and ushered in Margaret Thatcher. That's 8 p.m. on Sunday evening over on BBC Parliament. That was the Today in Parliament podcast. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor was Susan Hume. Thanks for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.com. radio4.co.uk/radio4.